still my soul. The Lord is on thy side.
Hello and very welcome to Mormon Stories Germany. The podcasts of Mormon Stories Germany are directed particularly at European or German listeners who self-identify as Mormons regardless of church affiliation or membership. Any participation or support of Mormon Stories Germany is aimed at building friendships and communities of support or healing, and to create places where sincere questions and honest inquiries are welcome. If you wish to support the building of communities in Central Europe, or the creation of podcasts, or even the website, then get in contact with me or become a subscriber at mormonstoriesgermany.org.
Leads to a joyful end.
Thank you so much for, you know, giving the listenership and a run through your vita. And now in the second part, would be fantastic if we could go into what happened in your mind and what happened in your testimony. And you indicated in your biography that you sent on something that you call Pandora's box being opened. And,
And
that was sort of the catalyst in your faith journey, happened by you reading Rough Stone Rolling, treatment of homosexuals, gender roles, and these kinds of things. And it would be fantastic to see how you dug into that, entering Fowler's stage four, if you will. When was that exactly? So what happened?
This would have started, I think, already by around probably 2005, 2006. I was just having questions about things. I do remember the question of homosexuality, of homosexuals, feeling a bit troubled by that. You know, I did at the time have the typical Mormon view that, you know, gay marriage was just something I couldn't support. And but I felt really conflicted by the notion that homosexuality was something that was a choice, and that people could simply choose to either be straight or celibate and live a happy, healthy life. And I think it must have been around probably 2008. Somehow I came across a story of Peter and Mary Danzig, who, I don't know, some of our listeners may remember them. They actually did an interview on Mormon Stories with John DeLynn. But I remember reading about their story. It was probably in the Salt Lake Tribune online. But what happened to Peter Danzig was he was exploring the questions of homosexuality while pursuing a graduate degree in clinical social work. And he was feeling really troubled by the church's stance on homosexuality and the treatment of homosexuals. And so he started to raise questions about it. And to make a long story short, both he and his wife ended up basically being forced to resign from the church, lightly been excommunicated or disfellowshipped because of their open disagreement, I guess, or questioning of the church's stance on homosexuality. So I remember being intrigued by his point of view, you know, as a professional, having a lot more knowledge on the subject than I did, and also kind of shocked. I guess I was naive at the time, but shocked that the church would treat him the way that they did because he was expressing his concerns and raising questions about this.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I think that's how I heard about the September 6th and about things like the treatment of homosexuals at BYU with like electroshock therapy and other things like, you know, blatant hardcore racism, you know, at BYU. And it became like a Pandora's box, because around this same time I had the opportunity to read Rough Stone Rolling. And so, I mean, that rocked my world totally, because I learned about polygamy, polyandry. I had no idea what polyandry was before then. I had also always struggled with the priesthood ban. That was something that we had talked a little bit about in our family, you know, coming from a multi-racial, multi-ethnic family. I remember, you know, hearing my parents, especially my dad, you know, express concerns and discomfort with the whole priesthood ban and some of the rhetoric surrounding, you know, black people and, you know, valiance and the pre-existence and so forth. So
yes, you would not have been familiar with that kind of a rhetoric and with that mindset of blacks being less than just purely based on their genetics or based on their upbringing. Coming from Canada and being a convert, that would not have resonated with him at all.
Right, yeah. And I remember Dad saying years ago that he just felt like the priesthood ban must have been, you know, the result of the racist views of the leaders at the time, which I agree with now. But at the time, I felt kind of shocked, you know, like, wow, you know, does this mean that, you know, the prophets can make mistakes, especially about something as big as this?
Mm-hmm.
And so from Rough Stone Rolling and from reading, you know, about the Danzigs and the September 6th, it became Pandora's box, you know. I started learning about other things too, and I came across the Bloggernacle, as we call it, you know, the Mormon blogosphere. And this was before Facebook had really taken off, so the Mormon blogging was a big thing. And I would read different blogs, and some of my favorites at the time, some people out there might remember them. I think some of them are still writing. A Mormon Heretic was one of my favorites for especially his historical posts about the priesthood ban. And I also read the blogs of several gay Mormons, and made some friends there. One blog called Gay LDS Actor, and I remember one really funny blog at the time called Soy Made Me Gay. This really creative gay Mormon who really poured out his heart on this blog. And
what does soy mean in that sense? Soy as
soy
a
as
Spanish
in
eye or
no no
soy
like
sauce
soy like soy sauce yeah
oh, okay.
Right. Because soy contains estrogen or chemicals that are like estrogen. So, I mean, some people have this crazy idea that if you eat enough soy, then, you know, men will become female. So he just chose this funny, you know, title, Soy Made Me Gay, right? Because of the estrogen. So, yeah.
As it would. As it would.
And I learned a lot from these bloggers and made some really good friends. And then around early 2008, I decided to start my own blog. And so that's when I started blogging as the Faithful Dissident.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you didn't quite divulge your identity in the internet just yet, right?
No. Why
were you afraid of that, and what did you think might happen?
I remember when I started the Faithful Dissident, I didn't want to divulge any information that I thought would make it possible to track me down, because I knew, for example, if I said I was in Norway, well, you know, how many Mormons are in Norway? And let alone if I said I was female and Canadian, you know, then I knew that I would be discovered right away. And I had seen in the log in my blog, IP addresses and stuff, I could see that people from inside the church had visited my blog, and I had no idea who these people were or why they would want to read it.
Yes.
And so I was afraid at the time of, at the time, I suppose this was before I was really out to my family, and I didn't know where I would end up. I had a lot of questions. I was feeling very conflicted. I was still active, I think, mostly active, but I wasn't happy at church, and things were sort of unraveling for me, and I felt like I needed a safe space to explore these issues and to talk about it, to interact with others who were going through the same thing. And if I were suddenly tracked down and hauled into like a disciplinary court or threatened discipline, it would have disturbed that process.
Okay, and that would have been, so this time when you started with blogging and being your own blogger, that would have been in 2008?
Perhaps? I think it was March 2008, okay. If I remember correctly.
All right, even March of 2008. All right, got it.
Yeah, and...
Would you have approached your branch president yet, and your stake president, or would that have come later?
I think that came later, if I remember correctly, because... I think I was pretty much, that was probably around the time when I was less active, when I just felt like it was getting to be too much. And, I do remember sharing, some thoughts and concerns I had with, I sent an email to a branch president and copied it, I think, to the stake president. And, the branch president, who's a very good guy, I really like him a lot. He sort of just deferred to the stake president. He really didn't much have to say, but the stake president, who also is a good guy, but just I think they were just both really ill-equipped to deal with these issues, and I didn't feel like I was being heard, and I felt like I was sort of, because he pretty much told me and that I had been colored by anti-Mormons, okay. You know, anti-Mormon literature, because of the questions I was raising, and that simply talking about these issues in the way that I believe mention Mormon Stories and John DeLynn, and I shared with him what are some of the issues, and he, I remember him writing to me and saying that, you know, people like John DeLynn, they may mean well, but, you know, there's a reason why anti-Mormons are looking at these resources, and that basically, you know, somebody like John DeLynn is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and you've obviously been affected by them, and, you know, like, just have more faith, you know, go to the temple, you know, all the usual things that you're supposed to do. And he acknowledged that he struggled with some things, you know, like he said, I have gay friends, and I too have struggled with the whole race question, but he didn't have any answers. And now that I look at it, I mean, I don't see how I could have expected anything else. And maybe I really didn't expect anything. I was just looking for, I think it was important for me to let them know why I was not attending church or why I was drifting away. And because something that I was really concerned about was I didn't want the members of the branch to assume that that it was Osmond who had pulled me away from the church.
Yes, yeah, you were quite
because
careful about
think,
that and
you know,
quite conscious.
Oh, married a non-member, that's what happens, right?
So it must have been wolves in sheep's clothing somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the States, somewhere you can put your finger on it. You know, clearly, Richard Bushman would not have been a wolf in sheep's clothing, right?
Exactly.
He wouldn't have known that. He wouldn't have even been able to put a finger on that one.
Yeah. So, but the whole blogging experience was a time of intense growth for me, in terms, I mean, not just the whole spiritual process or the, you know, losing my testimony, but I just learned a lot of things about the world and about a side of Mormonism that I really wasn't that familiar with. Because growing up in Canada, you know, definitely we were connected to the States, especially being, I mean, Sarnia is a border town. You know, there's only a river that separates Ontario and Michigan. And, you know, we're very affected by American culture and American Mormonism. But I discovered this whole other side to it through blogging and later through Facebook, because I guess I didn't really know that many American Mormons, you know, personally. And I discovered this whole other culture, especially in Utah, that
I
really wasn't so familiar with.
Yes, yeah, you wouldn't have been familiar at all with Utah culture.
Right, because, you know, this was the days before, you know, growing up in the church, that was before social media and before the internet, and I really wasn't aware. And so I think one of the areas where I really learned a lot was politics. And I don't know if you have any memories from that time, Henning, but the Obama election of 2008, I sort of feel like that was like a watershed moment in Mormonism, at least political Mormonism, maybe just because it was all so new to me, but I just felt like that really brought out a lot of craziness or nastiness that kind of shocked me in terms of, you know, like as an example, you know, as a Canadian, you know, I grew up with universal health care, right? And social benefits and welfare system in Canada. It's much the same in Europe. And suddenly I was interacting with American Mormons who were all very, you know, excited about the election coming up. And there was a really great blog at the time called Political LDS.
But that would have been in 2008, right?
That was 2008, yeah.
Okay, so that would have been the McCain-Palin campaign then.
Right,
not the Romney campaign.
Yeah.
All right, got it. Uh-huh.
And so, you know, suddenly I was hearing Mormons say, like, that they were against, you know, like, healthcare. And I'm like, this is a thing? This is a thing? Like healthcare is like, you know, they would refer to it as like socialism, you know, Satan's plan. And I'm like, wow, like, this is really a thing that people look at healthcare as like Satan's plan to, you know, destroy the kingdom of God? Like, I was shocked. And
those would be Latter-day Saints that would come up with these
verses?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, these were all Mormons. And I remember, you know, I would tell them how, by this time I was, I think, beginning to say that, oh, I live in Norway or I'm Canadian. And I would share how, you know, things work in our social democratic system and with healthcare and welfare system and so forth. So I remember people, you know, like drawing comparisons of Canada and North Korea and like just really crazy stuff. And so I learned quite a bit about socialism because socialism was like the big bad word, you know, during the, I remember with Palin, and if you remember Joe the Plumber, and, you know, socialism is a bad word in Mormonism. And so I had to ask myself, you know, what is socialism and am I a socialist? And
I guess it's so alienating to us Europeans because we would not term it as socialism, but we would term it as social democracy, right? And the socialism that resonates with us would be the one that comes back from the Stalin days that you would have had in Eastern Europe, particularly Eastern Germany.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, some of these people were not, they really could not see any difference between, like North Korean or like Soviet socialism and social democracy like Norway. To them, it was pretty much all the same thing. And so I learned a lot actually from that point of view, because I was also completely unfamiliar with like Ezra Taft Benson and the John Birch Society and this era of, especially with the civil rights movement and you know, statements regarding Martin Luther King and blacks and how that, you know, was all tied into Mormonism. And so I really had a lot to learn in terms of Mormon history from from that area, especially the Ezra Taft Benson era.
Mm-hmm.
And just now, how being a European or even a Canadian Mormon could be so different from a Utah Mormon, at least politically.
Okay. Do you get the sense from the church and church culture in modern days that it is broad enough and big tent enough to allow for a diversity of liberals and conservatives in that way of being under the same tent? Do you see that, or do you see that conservative views would strongly inhibit diversity?
I think one of the consequences of that 2008 election was I really saw a rise in what you would call the LDS left movement. I joined a Facebook group, which still exists today, called the LDS left. And so for a while, I would probably identify as an LDS lefty, because I realized, okay, I guess I am, wouldn't have classified myself maybe as a socialist, but as a social democrat. And I got to know a lot of people in the LDS left group, many of them Americans, actually, who were able to reconcile their Mormon faith, even living in some of the most conservative areas, with their leftist politics. So I do think that it's possible. And I think, honestly, outside of the U.S., at least in my experience, I don't know what your experience has been like in Germany, Henning, but in Norway, I attended church, I guess, for about 7-8 years, and politics was just never part of Mormonism here. I mean, not really. I hear, you know, stories of Mormons in the U.S. and even now in Canada from back home of American politics being a part of the discussion, like in Sunday school, and how members get really riled up over American political issues.
Which is strange, isn't it?
It is strange because here, you know, it's so irrelevant, you know?
Yeah, same in Germany. You wouldn't really have any campaigning going on for, let's say, 1 or 2 months before the election actually takes place, and you wouldn't be involved in seeing how a candidate of a particular party is being elected to being the representative that would represent his party as a chancellor.
Mm-hmm. And I think that members here, I can imagine they could vote in many different directions. I mean, everything from socialist to conservative. And I don't see why that would be a problem.
I guess what you see here in Germany is the question of gay marriage and the question of legal abortion. Those would be mm-hmm. things that would polarize even members. Other than that, mm-hmm. you don't really see any strong turn towards the conservative parties on the side of true-believing
right.
Latter-day Saints. You would have many true-believing Latter-day Saints that would be that would, you know, vote or advocate for the Green Party or for the Liberals or for the Social Democrats, as opposed to the Christian Democratic Union here, and that would be representative of what you would have as a Republicans over in the States, mm-hmm. right? So I guess in general, Mormons tend to be more conservative, but mm-hmm. that is just definitely not such a strong pull there as it would
right.
be in the States, and that seems to be very similar to what's going on in Norway.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, like, as an example, Norway's marriage equality law came into effect. I think it was 2007-8. Not quite sure, but you know, we see how big of a deal the Supreme Court ruling was in the U.S. and Proposition 8, and just how American Mormonism has been dominated by right-wing politics with regards to the gay marriage question. And here, because I would have still been attending church at the time, and I mean, I don't think that most of the members, you know, were really supportive of gay marriage by any means, but it just wasn't so much of an issue. And I can barely remember it even being mentioned when Norway changed its laws to allow for marriage equality. And, you know, I think the attitude, my impression at least, is that the attitude of members here is like, well, you know, it happened and it doesn't really affect us one way or the other. We can disagree with it, but there's nothing to get all riled up about in the way that we see, you know, in the U.S., these dire predictions of society's downfall and how the family's going to be torn apart. I mean, that just doesn't happen here.
Yeah, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are approaching every time the U.S. have an election. Isn't that amazing? It's just absolutely fascinating. I guess the absurdity of that soap opera is something that is so amazing to us here in Europe that we love to watch it, you know, and love to anticipate it. And I guess does something for their
somehow we're still standing, you know, these European countries and Canada, you know, despite gay marriage, you know, somehow we've managed to survive, right?
All right. Well, it's awesome to riff with you a little bit about American politics and European, you know, political landscape. But going back, so you were still around 2008, and you would have had the conversation with your branch president, or let's say not a conversation with your branch president, but particularly with your state president, perhaps. But would you say that your testimony would have tipped over the line, and that the dam would have broken? Back in the day, you mentioned something about having listened to Grant Palmer's podcast as well.
Definitely. So would have been around that time.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that as well?
I think, if I remember correctly, I probably, by the time I was having this email exchange with the state president, and really it was a very respectful exchange. I have nothing but respect for him and the branch president. Very nice, you know, thoughtful guys, and I guess I can't really blame them for their not being able to really deal with my questions. And I think by the time I had this email exchange with them, I was probably pretty much on my way out, and realizing that I just wasn't going to be able to make this middle way work for me. Because I think I mean, even, you know, through the whole what I discovered through the politics and all the questions that arose from that, and reconciling, I guess, my political ideas, and I'm sort of all over the place politically. I don't really identify with the left or the right. I suppose by American standards, I'm on the left, but by European standards, I can go pretty much anyway on most issues, and I'm quite moderate. So I wouldn't say that, you know, the politics is what drove me out of the church. I think that's a misconception. I think politics is a phase that a lot of people go through that may sort of be a catalyst to asking more questions, and then so it's a step in the process, perhaps, of leaving for a lot of people. So for me, I think what was impossible for me to reconcile was not the politics, but the history. And, you know, learning what I did about Joseph Smith and the origins of the church. And I listen, of course, to Mormon Stories avidly and read a lot. But I had a experience, I think, when I listened to Grant Palmer's first podcast with John DeLim. That would have been, what year it would have been, probably 2007, 8, I'm not sure. It was among the first episodes. I think it was around episode 30 of Mormon Stories. And that podcast with Grant, really, I remember listening to it in bed at night and feeling like I was at a turning point in my life, that things were never going to be the same. It was like I just finally had come to the conclusion, and I felt kind of at peace with the realization that, okay, the church is not true, you know, not like I had been taught that it was. It wasn't what I thought it was. Joseph Smith, he either made the whole thing up, lied, or he was perhaps deluded. And
which essentially is the very same thing that your first boyfriend told you, right?
Yes, isn't that ironic?
It is ironic.
Yeah. And
would that be the conclusion that Grant Palmer would have come to, though?
Yeah, I have to think back to what he actually said, but I...
Well, I do remember him bearing a strong witness of his encounter with the Redeemer, right, at least by spirit. Mm-hmm.
Where, yeah, because he's still very Christian, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Grant,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, he gave a very moving testimony of how he...
Yes.
How he was... How he felt the voice of the Lord telling him, look, it's all going to be okay, just immediately after his arduous excommunication that he went through.
Right. And I felt I could really relate to that feeling he was describing, even though to me it wasn't like I felt like that I was being given a revelation from God or Jesus. I think I didn't really have an opinion about that one way or the other. I just knew that I felt like, okay, all this was disturbing. Like, now I finally realized this was all just, it just wasn't what I've been led to believe for almost 30 years. But at the same time, it was a huge relief. I remember feeling like just this burden had been lifted, and that now I could finally stop these exhausting mental gymnastics of trying to reconcile things that just felt like they couldn't be reconciled, and trying to fit into this box, and still, you know, dealing with the guilt of having married outside of the church and never going to be able to be what I was supposed to be. And even though I had already started to let go of those ideas, now it was like I was really starting to feel the freedom, and it felt exhilarating and incredibly liberating.
Would you say, would you go as far as to say that this was a turning point for your initial anxiety and feelings of depression that you had ever since your youth?
It's interesting because at the time, I think after I came to this realization, I felt quite at peace, really, and free, and had a really good period in my life, which we can go into soon when I started working with asylum seekers. But actually, in 2011, I hit a really difficult period that sort of came out of the blue for me. I didn't expect it to come right then, because I thought I was finally really at peace with the church and had put the worst of it behind me, and that I was moving forward.
Okay.
And but in 2011, I had a really a scary experience, something I had never experienced before, even though I had struggled with anxiety and depression and the physical symptoms of it. It manifested itself so intensely, so strongly, that even with my previous experience and knowledge, I didn't recognize it as being depression related. And so what happened was I remember having I had a strep throat infection, and just feeling kind of under the weather and struggling with headaches and difficulty swallowing, which isn't so unusual when you have strep throat. Mm-hmm. But once I recovered from the infection, I was not feeling any better. And so for a period of several months, it would be a bit up and down, but I got to the point where I was almost not eating anything. And it wasn't because I was, you know, anorexic or, you know, had issues with food. It was because I had such immense tension built up in my body that it was affecting the muscles in my head. I was having like chronic tension headaches by this time, and the muscles like in my throat and in my face and my neck. And so for a while I thought that the doctor thought perhaps it was a bad sinus infection. You know, I had this really bad sinus pressure, and was sent for a CT scan, and everything came out negative. All my blood work was fine, and just couldn't figure out what was going on. I did a lot of research online, and I was getting really bad by this point because I was hardly eating. I was losing weight, and by this time, I was starting to feel more like of a classic depression setting in, because I was starving all the time and had no energy and just felt awful. So eventually I realized, you know, maybe this is something psychological. I mean, the physical symptoms are very real, but there wasn't a pathological reason for them. You know, there wasn't, I wasn't physically ill. And so I went to my doctor, and he prescribed an antidepressant. And this was the first time I had periods of my life previously I had considered perhaps consulting my doctor about trying an antidepressant during difficult periods, but I would always bounce back, and so I never went down the road of medication. But now I was desperate, so I was prescribed an antidepressant, and he referred me to a neuropsychologist. So after a couple of weeks, I started to feel a difference, and then things got gradually better. Since then, I've been talking to a neuropsychologist, which is really good for me because she has an understanding of the brain and how it works, and my physical symptoms, and how to deal with them, and to, you know, we've talked a lot about the church and other things in my past that may have affected me, and so learning how, I guess, to deal with those and to recognize, you know, thought patterns that aren't so good for me.
Okay. So you already alluded to this, right? Speaking about the asylum seekers and having worked with them. When did you start working with asylum seekers? Was that part of the refugee crisis that we obviously experienced here in Germany particularly, or was that a lot sooner already?
Well, what happened was this would have been around, it would have been 2010. So
okay,
this
that
was,
is really quite early then, and that would have been initially after your after the dam broke for your testimony.
There. Right. So this was just around the time that I was leaving the church. It was around the time, I guess you could say I was going through the death throes of Mormonism, because I remember the last time I attended church was in May of 2010. And I still remember my last church sacrament meeting. There was a member of the branch presidency giving a talk. And, you know, once again, a good guy, nothing against these people. But in the talk, he was talking about polygamy and how sometimes, you know, there's a reason for it, and that it was approved by God, and in the same breath, you know, was condemning homosexual relationships, and I just felt like I was done. I thought
that's crazy.
You know, I'm done, and I said to myself, if I miss it, I'll come back. I didn't consciously say, okay, this is the last time I'm ever coming to church. I said, you know, I feel like I need to leave, that I'm done, but if I miss it, I'll come back.
So hold on, this guy was actually in church when he advocated for polygamy.
Yeah,
was just a participant in Elders' Court? Or no, obviously not Elders' Court,
no, this
court
was in
Sunday school or something. In sacrament meeting. So he gave a talk, he advocated for polygamy in the sacrament meeting.
Right, advocated for I mean, not polygamy now, but that polygamy in our history was for a reason, and that it was approved of, you know, by God.
Okay.
That it was divinely inspired.
Okay, all right. And he had a clear stance against homosexual relationships of any kind in that same talk.
Right. Uh-huh. And it was as simple as that God has said so, that that's the way it's supposed to be.
Awesome. Okay. So, right. And then you said that was sort of what made the barrel tip over, right?
Mm.
So you didn't go back afterwards.
Right. Okay, so right. It was around this time, just previous to this, because my last church service was in May. It was in February of that same year. I can tell first a bit about how this asylum process works in Norway and in Europe, because for any of our North American listeners, it's quite different, because although, you know, Canada and the U.S. accepts a lot of immigrants, Canada and the U.S. do not get the number of asylum seekers that Europe does. Because of Europe's geographical location versus North America's geographical location, it's just simply easier for people to get to Europe and to apply for asylum. So most of the what we would call refugees who are coming to Canada or the U.S., these are people who have already been, you know, processed and given refugee status by UNHCR and are coming to North America and being able to resettle as refugees. And whereas in Europe, most of these people are undocumented asylum seekers, migrants, who are coming to countries all over Europe and trying to get asylum. And they're coming now in the millions, you know, as we've seen this year.
Yeah, we're clearly seeing different numbers.
Right.
Because in the States, there are, 72,000 that they have accepted this year, just in the United States.
Right. And
it's amazing, right? If you think about the impact American politics has on what is actually going on in the Middle East that caused these issues,
mm-hmm.
you would have thought that they would carry a bulk of the burden of that crisis.
Yeah, that's been
out.
A big,
big all discussion. Of them end up in Western Europe. And,
right.
So, Germany has accepted some... roughly a million. So we were actually forecasting 800,000 this year, but it ended up more like a million.
Yeah. And one important thing to clarify is that when we say that Europe has accepted, over a million refugees, accepted does not mean that they have been accepted in the same sense that, for example, a refugee through UNHCR is being accepted into Canada now from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Because these people, like I said, have already been processed, they've been approved, and they're being accepted and resettled into Canada and they're being given refugee status. Now, many of these asylum seekers, of the roughly 1 million asylum seekers that have come to Germany, how many of those are actually going to be accepted and given legal status in Germany remains to be seen.
That is correct. Although that being said, Angela Merkel made it very, very clear that she wants for these people to contribute into the social security system. They would have to work for that, right? So that gives you a little bit of an indication there that this is not just an interim number, because the people that will end up staying will probably pull in their families as well.
Yes, exactly. So in the case of Germany, that's a good point about them being able to work, because what choice do you have when you have over a million people? You can't have a million people sitting and doing nothing, and they could be there for years as their cases are being processed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the case everywhere. In Norway, asylum seekers normally are not able to work. So this year in Norway, we've received about 30,000 asylum seekers. In Sweden, it's, I think, 80,000 plus.
Okay.
So Sweden per capita, I believe, based on their population, has received at least as many as Germany has, I think.
Yeah.
So they're overwhelmed, absolutely.
Percentage-wise.
Yeah. So, but the way it works in Norway is that when an asylum seeker comes to Norway and they usually go to a police station, usually in Oslo, and they'll apply for asylum. And from there, they're sent to something that in Norwegian we call an asylmottak, which means an asylum, like a asylum seeker reception center. And these centers are spread all throughout the country, from Oslo to down south in Norway to far in the north. And so while these people are waiting for their applications to be processed by the immigration authorities, they will live at one of these centers for sometimes it can be years. I know of people who have lived there for 6-7 years. There's even a horror story of one poor man from Eritrea who has not been accepted, but he can't be sent back either. And he's living there. He's been living there now for over 25 years in political limbo, with no right to work, no right to go to school. It's a very difficult situation.
Awful.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's like being stuck in prison, right?
It is. It's
because
it's
he can't work, he can't go to school, he can't do anything. Right. All he can do is just get the couple of hundred euros a month from the legal authorities, and has to be there per indefinite.
Yeah.
My goodness. Okay.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. So one of these centers happened to be in the town where I live, in Welf. And it has since closed. They closed it last year because it needed too many renovations. But in 2010, I had read a story in the local newspaper about this place. And, you know, I had seen it and passed by it and thought, well, I wonder what it would be like to go there, you know? Like, I knew there were people from different countries, and I thought, well, you know, would they welcome me? Would it be safe? And but anyway, in this newspaper article, it said that while the local Norwegian population was really good about donating things, you know, like clothes and old washing machines and TVs, it was very difficult to get people to want to come and spend time with these people and talk to them. Because, remember, most of them are not allowed to work. Some of them go to like a Norwegian class for a few months maybe, but after that there's nothing left for them to do. So I got in contact with the manager of the camp, as they called it, and he welcomed me, a Norwegian guy. And he showed me around and introduced me to people from many different countries. And so that was the beginning of a really important and enriching experience in my life. And that it really taught me a lot about people and the world, because, you know, I met people from Afghanistan, Somalia, Palestine, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Chechnya, Iran, Iraq, Turkey.
Many Syrians as well?
At the time, no. There was actually, in 2010, I remember there only being one Syrian family. And they had initially had their application rejected, but later on they had it overturned once things in Syria got really bad.
Mm.
So, from my first day there, I was overwhelmed by the warmth of these people. Like, these people, many of them were just starving for contact with the outside world, you know? Because most Norwegian people never enter the doors of a place like this. And the first day that I came, they thought I was a new asylum seeker, you know, because I don't look Norwegian, and they were sure that I was Iranian or Kurdish. And I said, well, no, I'm from Canada. And they That just made no sense to them, why a Canadian was coming to the camp. But on my very first day, I remember thinking, I had the day off, and I thought, I'll probably spend, I don't know, maybe an hour or so talking to people. I ended up spending 8 hours there because, you know, they made me dinner. They wanted to hear about Canada and about my life in Norway and about my family. And, of course, I wanted to hear their stories, you know, to hear where they were from. And I met some really, really nice people, a really nice family, a mother, a widow from Iraq whose husband had been kidnapped in Baghdad, presumed dead, and she escaped with her two young daughters, and they got asylum. They're still here. And another young man from Afghanistan, who we've become very close with. He ended up becoming like a family member to us now. And but I was just blown away by their hospitality and the stimulating conversation. And so they treated me so kindly and made some really good friends. And I knew that they really sincerely enjoyed my company, and I did theirs as well. And so it was a very worthwhile experience.
So what happened in your own thought process of emancipating yourself from your Mormon upbringing by working with those asylum seekers?
Yeah.
You indicated that you drew some parallels between Mormonism and Islam, and some of the statements coming from general authorities with some of the statements coming from Islam leaders.
Yeah. So most of the people that I met, of course, were Muslims. Some were Shia, especially amongst the Hazara population. Hazara is an ethnic minority in Afghanistan. And for those who have read the Kite Runner, the boy Hassan in the Kite Runner, he was Hazara. And the Hazara is an oppressed ethnic minority in Afghanistan who has really suffered under the Taliban and now still, you know, from the Pashtun majority and now ISIS as well. So I got to know them, and most of the others were Sunni Muslims. And so I was, you know, here I was coming out of my experience with Mormonism, and I wasn't looking for a new religion by any means, but I was curious. And one thing that I really liked about hanging out with these Muslims was it sort of felt like hanging out with Mormons again, but in a way that I didn't have to carry all this baggage that I did as a Mormon, because I wasn't a Muslim. I wasn't one of them. I don't think that they were expecting me to become Muslim. But, you know, one thing I really love about Mormonism that I always loved and I still do is, you know, the way of life in terms of what we would call like clean living. Muslims don't normally drink. They're not big partiers. They're big on family. They're really friendly. And, you know, a lot of the same really positive characteristics that you find in Mormons, you find in Muslims as well. I felt at home with them. And, of course, I was curious about the religion. And, you know, I had heard, you know, things about Islam and Muslims from the media and from reading, and I didn't really know what to expect, whether there was anything to fear, you know, or were things that I had heard, you know, negative things about Islam or Muslims, was it just exaggerations, was it blown out of proportion? I just wanted to find out for myself. So I was going in with a blank slate. And I was open to meeting with them, talking with them, and I read the Quran and met...
The whole thing?
You read the whole Quran, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got to know a young man from Somalia, very nice, very polite young man, spoke very good English, and very, very devout Muslim. And I think we had talked a little bit about religion. I had probably told him that I was Mormon, that I had been Christian, and that I was interested in learning about religion. And so he pulled out a copy of the Quran, And he lent it to me, and I said, I promise I'll read it. And I'm sure he was hoping that I would become converted. The Quran that he gave me was, it was in English. It was a translation by, I believe it was back from the 1970s, I can't remember, but it was by a Muslim scholar, I guess, and complete with commentary on the text. And it was, I realized, I think it's important to point out that there are many different interpretations of the Quran, just as there are with the Bible. So I realized that I only read one interpretation of it and that there are others. The one that I read was, I think, a very conservative interpretation. Whereas the, you know, the Quran text itself is basically the same, regardless of the version. The interpretation was quite extreme in its descriptions of Jews, of debates over the role of women, and, for example, how far it is acceptable to discipline your wife in accordance with Sharia law. You know, like how much of a beating can you give her? what is acceptable, what isn't? And so that was disturbing. Also,
did you approach your Somali friend about this?
I didn't.
Okay.
I think I was becoming aware of the darker side of Islam and some of their beliefs, but I wanted to focus solely on their positive qualities and the nice conversations we were having and the friendships I was developing, and I felt like I didn't want to rock the boat, and I was a little bit unsure of how they would react.
Yes.
If I challenged them.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. And I've had similar experiences where I actually approached the darker side and got some negative repercussions from that as well.
Right.
Did you have a chance to go into, let's say, different interpretations there as well? Or did you only focus on the conservative interpretation there? Did you have a chance to go into Sufi text, Sufi mysticism at all? Anything?
No, I read a book about Islam that touched on Sufism, but I haven't really read too much about it, also because I don't know any Sufis. I think I was more curious about the Shia and Sunni, because they're the majority of the Muslims here in Norway, especially Sunni. And so, but back to my Somali friend, I remember after I had read the Quran, he sent me a video on Facebook. I think it was his way of like proselytizing to me, sort of the same way that a Mormon would give somebody the Book of Mormon and encourage them, you know, to pray about it. And he sent me some video clips about Islam. And I remember him saying something like, oh, when you see these, you'll realize the truth or whatever. And it was just this really awful portrayal of Jews. And it was quite disturbing. I only saw it once, and I didn't respond to him, and I never heard back from him. He left and resettled in Germany, actually.
So he hoped that you would discover the truth of Islam by a material that focuses on bashing Jews?
I suppose he hoped that I would realize that, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition was wrong, and that the Islamic tradition was the right one.
Okay.
And
okay.
That I would come to realize the truth through that. I don't know. I don't know what his line of thinking was. But back to your question about, you know, other interpretations. I haven't read any other interpretations of the Quran, but I have read different interpretations online. Everything from really horrible conservative, like ultra-conservative views on women, where, you know, that advocate the beating of women, all the way to, you know, people who completely repudiate those views. And I think more recently, I've become aware of even feminists within Islam. There's a strong feminist movement. In some ways, you could even say that a small number of them have maybe even gotten further than their Mormon counterparts. I've read, in fact, of some female imams in the U.S. I mean, they're not many, but female imams who are at least administering to other female Muslims in their local communities. So I think that's important to point out, that there are just so many different ways of interpreting the Quran and of living Islam, just as it is with really any other religion as well.
Okay.
There's constant debate about what's Islamic doctrine and what isn't. I mean, isn't it the same in Mormonism? Try to have a conversation with Mormons. What's Mormon doctrine and what isn't? Good luck.
Be still, my soul. The Lord is on thy side.
Thank you for listening. The music for this podcast episode comes from The Lower Lights. You can visit their website at thelowerlights.com. The logo has been donated by StudioCase.com. I'm wishing you all the very best until next time, here at Mormon Stories Germany.
In every change, he faithful will